Right, yeah.
Now it's recording.
Yeah, good.
And that's all you do.
Now this is...
I believe that is... we stopped around in 356 feet, if I remember well. Yes. That is so good as a discussion. together with Protagoras, with the human being, well, with the many, with the violent, and we were in the midst of it. I remind you briefly of the context. There was one passage which we didn't particularly consider. Now the question is this. According to both Socrates and Protagoras, knowledge, science, is the most powerful thing in man. And yet we see that people knowing the better choose the worse, overcome by pleasure and other passions. But the human beings who make this objection understand by better or worse, or rather by good and bad, the pleasant and the painful. That was explained to them at painful length. And that means that people knowing the more pleasant choose the more painful, overcome by pleasure. Yeah? Do I have to illustrate it by a homely example, or is it clear now? Good. And now let us turn first to 356a, 5-7. Well, perhaps you read 356a altogether, that we see the context a bit.
Are there any circumstances in which pleasure is inferior to pain, other than when there is an excess and defect in their mutual relations, which means that they become greater and smaller, and more and fewer, and differ in degree? For if anyone says, yes, Socrates, but the pleasure of the moment differs widely from future pleasure and pain.
Yes, that's the one thing. The great difference, it is true, the pleasure we have at a given moment, say from some candy or cigarette, may be very trivial compared with the pain which we get afterwards. Yet there is an enormous difference between the present pleasure and the future pain. The present has a singular power. Now, Socrates' reply is to this effect. The difference of present and future is not a difference in regard to the quantity of pleasure. In other words, the pleasure of the candy now is quantitative, the same as the pleasure of the candy at some future or any other time. Now, if present pleasure is X, and the pain to which it leads is 1,000 X, one must forego the present pleasure. Everyone knows that. It is as simple as that. But does not the present, as these vulgar people say, have a much greater power than the remote? This is a difficulty with which Socrates is saddled still, and Protagoras too. Now let us then go on where we left off last time, that is 356c4.
Well then, I shall say, if you agree so far, be so good as to answer me a question. Do not objects of the same size appear larger to your sight when near, and smaller when at a distance? They will acknowledge that.
Who says that? The letter, the last one.
It seems to be Socrates.
No.
But
That's Protagoras. Sure. Now, he discusses now how the many answer the question of how present nearness and future, remoteness, affect how magnitudes appear to the many, the hands on whom we look down. So Tagore agrees with what Sukadev said about what the many will say. You remember his caginess from last time. He doesn't wish to be caught. Yes?
And the same holds of thickness and number. Also sounds, which are in themselves equal, are greater when near and lesser when at a distance.
You know this. Now he applies now the same what is true of length, is true also of number, of manyness, and of thickness. And of sound. I do not quite understand this selection of the examples. Protagoras answer, what, now what is Protagoras' answer here?
They will grant battle.
Oh no, they would say that. He doesn't say they will say that. It's in Greek optative with and, not indicative. So Protagoras' answer is here slightly qualified. Perhaps we find a reason in what follows. Yes?
Now suppose doing well to consist in doing or choosing the greater, and in not doing or in avoiding the less, what would be the saving principle?
The greater length, yeah? Length, literally. Because otherwise great might be middle. In other words, if our happiness would consist in getting the greatest possible length, yeah? Good. Yes?
What would be the saving principle of human life?
More simple, what would be the salvation of life? Salvation of life, meaning life as such, plus happiness, of course. Yes?
Would it be the art of measuring or the power of appearance?
The power of what comes to sight. You know, that is the power, for example, the candy now, as being now, before us. A power which the candy in Indochina would not have. Yes?
Is not the latter that deceiving art which makes us wander up and down?
Art, he says? Of course not an art. The power of the appearing things, not an art. That is, yeah. The power of the appearing made us.
That deceiving power, which makes us wander up and down, and take at one time the things of which we repent at another, both in our actions and in our choice of things great and small. But the art of measurement would invalidate the power of appearance, and, showing the truth, would fain teach the soul at last to find lasting rest in the truth, yeah, and would thus save our life. Would not mankind generally...
Again, the human beings with this ambiguity. Yeah.
Would not the human acknowledge that the art which accomplishes this result is the art of measurement? Yes, he said, the art of measurement.
Yeah, so in other words here, again, you see, would the many or the humans not agree? The art of measurement, he agrees. Both the many and Protagoras agree, but they agree to different things. The many agree that the measuring art is the help, and Protagoras only agrees that the many would say so. And we have to, in the case of length, we deprive the appearances of their power by the art of measuring. I believe this does not need any commentary. Yeah? If we see a man very far away, he looks as if he were 2 feet high, and then we take his, send someone there, or perhaps by some clever devices we can measure him from here, and then we see 6 feet. And of course then how the impression he makes on us is completely exploded by the measure. Yeah, that is clear. But since he has referred to sound, what about can sound be measured? Or to make it more simple, can smell be measured? we say one smell is stronger, greater, let us say, than another, or lesser than another. That can be measured. By preferring now a pleasant smell to an unpleasant one, we might get in the end a terrible stench. That is the same problem. Do we need measuring in order to prefer now the unpleasant smell to that perfume? And does measuring as such overcome the attractiveness of the present pleasant smell? After all, that this fellow looks as if he's 2 feet high is not attractive. It doesn't make the slightest difference to us if we find out that he's 6 feet high. At any rate, not in all cases, it seems, can the power of the appearance be overcome by measuring. Now, we are a bit the example of sound is not so very good, because today we would, of course, say or speak of wavelengths. But these are no longer sounds and sounds. These are things which go with sound. And now, I believe there are no smell waves, are they? Which they measure? Are they, do they have any device for measuring smell?
No, no, it's quite complicated chemistry.
For all practical purposes, we have to rely on our sense of smell. So, and this is where the answer is. Yes.
I'm not clear of the point what
No, he speaks here only of greater and smaller sounds. Well, if someone fires a gun here, and if he fires a gun, say, at City Hall, assuming we would hear it, and then obviously the sound we hear in this room would be much greater than the sound we would hear when. That is what it means, very simple.
Right, so why isn't the art of measuring the
important? Yeah, but the point is this. There is no application made in the sequel of an art of measuring sounds anyway. So in other words, the fact that there is in a certain dimension, the greater and the less, doesn't it yet prove that there is an art of measurement there? That's the point at which I tried. And I thought the example of smell is more simple, because we don't know of smell waves in the way in which we know of sound waves. This I thought, that was the only reason I mentioned that. But it is perfectly legitimate, of course, if you adduce the example of smell also to think of of sound also to think of smell, or of other things which where there other sense perceptions where there is a, for example, something is more pungent, food is more pungent than the other. It's also a more and less, and yet not necessarily an art of measuring. You expose your tongue to both sense impressions, and where you get the stronger impression, then you say that the smell or taste is strong. At any rate, but disregarding this grave difficulty, in the case which Sukadev mentioned, regarding sheer length, by measuring instead of merely trusting the sense experience, we bring it about that the soul stands by the truth, abides by the truth. Here is again the connection between knowledge and courage. If courage means to stand by something respected, say by the truth, this firmness of knowledge is something akin to the firmness of the courageous man. It brings it also about that we save our lives, as he put it here, and saving our lives is at least not the primary function of courage. You see here the problem of, after all, the problem with which we are concerned here is the relation of knowledge and courage. The answer of Protagoras is ambiguous. One can also say he seems to admit that he agrees as well as the many do. This is not quite as unambiguous as I said before. Now we come to another complication.
Suppose again the salvation of life to depend on the choice of odd and even, and on the knowledge of when a man ought to choose the greater or less, either in reference to the same quantity or to another, and whether near or at a distance. What would be the principle that makes to the...
No principle. What would save us our lives?
What would save
us? Let us speak much less of principles than we, including the translators of Plato. Yes.
Would not...
This doesn't mean that he doesn't think less of principles than we and the translators. Yes. Yes?
Would not knowledge, a knowledge of measuring, since this is the art that has to do with excess and defect, and a knowledge of number, when the question is of odd and even, the world that many humans will assent.
Is this art, since the subject is the odd and even, any art other than arithmetic? Yes?
Oh. The world will assent, will take out.
No, of course, the human being will assent. Would agree with us, or would they not? Now?
Protagoras himself thought that they would.
No, if they seemed to agree, or assent, also, it seemed also to Protagoras that they would agree. This is a much more qualified answer. Now, here is a complication. Now, in the raising of the question here regarding the more or less, and this is of course a very good example, because very people are concerned with getting richer and richer, which means more dollars, more that can be expressed in numerical terms. And here is that is very, very appropriate here. But here the question is not simply choosing more, but choosing more at the right time. You see that? Read it again, if there is any doubt about it. When one should correctly choose the more and when the less. In other words, there is a certain criticism of the so-called homo economicus, who doesn't raise the question in this form, except accidentally, because it might... Well, of course, there is a time... the bullish and the bearish people, that is a difference between the time, but in a very different sense. So many would not see this crucial difference. And Protagoras, therefore, dissociates himself from them again. Yes. But these are, of course, only examples, the art of measurement and the art of counting, because that is the meaning which arithmetic has to the Greeks. What we call arithmetic was called by them logistics, the operation with numbers. Arithmetic is the knowledge of the numbers as numbers. It has nothing to do, of course, with modern theory of numbers. But it is simply the knowledge of numbers. Someone who that you know, for example, if you have a very high and unusual number, of course, all the natural numbers, that you know what the next number would be. Yeah? Say 456,812. We all know it will be 456,813. But someone who has not learned numbers would not know it. Yes.
Well, I don't think he says the fact that he's But Socrates' question seems to be based on that proceeding, that would seem to take that into account. It would be saying, well, it depends on measurements and all of us make the right choice. And many of the people who admit this, when they know that they not, it seems to be that people do take it into account.
The key point is that the consideration of the right moment is not an arithmetical consideration. If it is a question of getting more and more money, that is easy. $1 million is more than $800,000. But whether one should do it now, and if it is the proper situation, a proper occasion, that is not, you are not told by arithmetic. Good. Now let us continue. Because now we come from the example to the our case. Yes.
Well then, human, I say to them, seeing that the salvation of life has been found to consist in the right choice of pleasures and pains,
i.e. not of numbers or of length. Because these were only examples to illustrate it. Yes?
In the choice of the more and the fewer, and the greater and the less, and the nearer and remoter, must not this measuring be a consideration of their excess and defect and equality in relation to each other? This is undeniably true. And this, as possessing measure, must undeniably also be an art and science. They will agree, he says.
They will agree. He doesn't say that he agrees. Now, in the case of pleasure, as distinguished from sheer length and sheer number, one would have to consider the more or less, the greater or smaller, and the remoter and nearer. That is, today we would need an art of measurement, which is at the same time ordinary art of measurement and the art of arithmetic, and yet preserve the temporal distance element. In other words, takes into due consideration that a present pleasure has a terrific attraction. Consideration which is not necessary in the other fields. The question of, so we have to consider, in order to act wisely, we have to consider, all right, this pleasure will bring us pain. But then, again, strictly, practically speaking, when? When in 60 years from now, I believe in the case of a man of my age, that would be a no consideration against him. And in the case, well, you know, that would, but still, you see, this question is wholly alien to the strictly mathematical art. I, of course, here very important. Good. But at any rate, this is all admitted by the human beings, and Protagoras admitting that they would admit it, we have perfect agreement. And this will find its seal, its confirmation, very soon. Yes?
The nature of this art or science will be a matter of future consideration.
One second. Which, not nature, what this art and science is, we will consider on another occasion. And now, in other words, we do not yet, it has been proved that we need this kind of a measuring art, which is not the ordinary measuring art. But what it is, where we find it, and perhaps even whether it is possible, this will not be settled in the Protagoras. So we get a wonderful blank check, and not more. And we don't know whether Protagoras or Socrates has anything on his mind, a phenomenon which we know also from present day phenomena. Yes, go on.
But the demonstration that it is a science has been adequately made, and that is what you asked of me and Protagoras. At the time when you asked the question, if you remember, both of us were agreeing that there was nothing mightier than knowledge, and that knowledge, in whatever existing, must prevail over pleasure and all other things. And then you said that pleasure...
You said, I mean then. Let's say the intellectuals say the intellect is the most powerful thing, and the non-intellectuals deny it. The line is as sharply drawn, yes?
That pleasure often prevails, even over a man who has knowledge, and we refuse to allow it. And you rejoin, O Protagoras and Socrates, what is the meaning of being overcome by pleasure, if not this? Tell us what you call such an event. If we had immediately and at the time answered ignorance, you would have laughed at us. But now, in laughing at us, you would be laughing at yourself.
Yes. Now, why and how has it been proven that it is only a matter of ignorance? By the example of length and other things. There is simply an optic delusion which can be corrected by measurement. And if someone would see that, to take an example from Rousseau, which is quite impressive in his Aeneid, when he speaks at that time that there is very much stricter notions than prevail today, what shall you do with a young man in order to prevent him from having intercourse at too early an age? Yeah, outside of marriage. And Rousseau has a very simple device which he got from an old office, army officer. This man took his young son into a hospital of people in the last stage of syphilis. And said, this is what is in store for him. And that made it a very deep impression on the world. Something of this kind, kind of education is in another way, of course, always possible, perhaps even still in this way, as far as I know. So at any rate, now they have learned that what overcomes them is just ignorance. They do not see themselves as being ruined by such things, or by the loss of their property, or a loss of reputation, or whatever it may be. That's plain ignorance. That has now been settled. Now here, when Socrates says, you asked us, he repeats literally what was said in 53a, 4-6. It is a very rare case, a literal repetition in Plato. The quotation marks, of course, are the additions of the modern editor. There are no quotation marks mentioned. There is only one tiny little bit of a change. In he says now, tell us, yeah? He uses now the plural, whereas in the first version, in the first statement, he had used the dual. In Greek, there is the verb a dual form, which means you too eat. It is grammatically different from you more than. Yeah? And this is an absolutely trivial difference, which, however, is of some importance, because at that time there were only Socrates and Protagoras, and now many, because this prepares what will happen in the near future, the enlargement of the Socrates-Protagoras group into one embracing also Hippias and Prodicus, as we shall see very soon. Now, and that he quotes so literally when reproducing a statement of the human being is, of course, in accordance with the presupposed view of the human being. Here you have to be very literal because of their lack of flexibility. We will find another case shortly later where he quotes Protagoras and where the changes are much greater. Because in the case of an intelligent man, he wouldn't stick to every particular word which is not decisively important. But a man who is not flexible and thinks every little word might count, who has no judgment of what is important is not, that I believe is the simplest explanation. Yes?
For you also admitted that men err in their choice of pleasures and pains, that is, in their choice of good and evil, from defects of knowledge. And you admitted further that they err not only from defects of knowledge in general, but of that particular knowledge which, as you also agreed earlier in the discussion, is called measuring.
The art of measuring.
The measuring. The art of measuring. And you are also aware that the erring act which is done without knowledge is done in ignorance. This, therefore, is the meaning of being overcome by pleasure, ignorance, and that the greatest. And our friends, Protagoras and Prodicus and Hippias, declare that they are the physicians of ignorance, but you, who are under the mistaken impression that ignorance is not the cause, and that the art of which I am speaking cannot be taught, neither go yourselves nor send your children to the sophists, who are the teachers of these things.
A bit more even. You don't send them to the teachers of those things. See sophists here. Yes.
These sophists here. You are concerned about your money and give them none. And the result is that you are the worst off, both in public and private life.
Yes. Now this is the conclusion of this section. Socrates presents himself here as a man who incites people, who pushes people forward to sophistry. The Greek word is protreptic. That is protreptikos, as sophistry came. That is, of course, terrific. Now, Socrates teaches here Protagoras how he should make such, should make propaganda, as you would say, for his own art. That's the way to do it, not the way in which you do it. And he also shows that his Protagoras' claim to teach virtue stands and falls by the identification of virtue and knowledge, which Protagoras was unwilling to admit. Socrates, of course, admits now, as you see in this context, that virtue is teachable, which he had originally denied. The Athenians don't teach virtue. Or the legislators of old don't teach virtue, but these men who possess that art of measurement, which has been sketched without its possibility having been established, this would be the true salvation of our life. Well, I believe it is true that if we would choose a greater evil, future evil instead now, and we would see with the utmost vivacity the terrible consequences to which it leads, if there would be such a knowledge which we could produce in the present moment, it would have some influence on our actions. But the question is whether such an art exists, whether one would not have to proceed in an entirely different way. Now, I believe here we are at an end of, not of the last section, of course, because you see there are still a couple of pages left, but it is a very important incision within the seventh and last section of the dialogue, and we should stop here for a moment and reconsider the whole last section. I told you what the difficulty is. The facts which we have to explain regarding the last section are these. First, why the emphasis on the question of courage? Secondly, why does Sugarez try to prove the identity of wisdom and courage on the basis of the identification of the good with the pleasant? And third, why is this identification established in a fictitious dialogue between Sugarez, who has Protagoras in his Hippocrates at the time, and the human being? Now, first, the first thing, why the emphasis on courage? What I'm going to say, I will repeat things which I have said before, but I hope they are now more coherent and clearer. Now, Protagoras asserts that surely courage is radically different from the other virtues, and hence in particular from wisdom. Now why? Well, courage was the only virtue not yet discussed. Hence it is the only virtue regarding which he can hope to maintain his original thesis regarding the parts of virtue, that they are independent of each other, separable from one another. But why did Sugarez not bring in courage earlier? Sugarez had led up to this pair of virtues, justice and piety here, moderation and wisdom there. Now, the kinship of these two couples, of each of these two pairs, is more obvious than the kinship of courage with one of the two groups. Courage seems to be in a class by itself. Now, why is it so? We must remember Protagoras' doctrine of virtue as developed in his long speech at the beginning, together with the myth and around the myth. Political virtue, as he calls it there, is the virtue of human beings. Now, human beings, again, is a technical meaning, not hombres. And that was said to consist of justice, piety, and moderation. We can say the virtue of the herd, understood in contradistinction to the virtue of the hombres, of which he did not speak there. In that long speech, he was silent on courage and wisdom. Courage and wisdom are these higher qualities, these distinguishing qualities, and if anyone doubts that this distinction is alien to Plato, he has only to read Callicles' speech in the Gorgias. The real he-man is characterized not by these herd virtues, justice, moderation, piety, but by wisdom, intelligence, whatever you call it, and courage. Well, up to the present day, it's intelligible. I don't believe that Mr. Giancarlo is proud of his justice, piety, and moderation, but he is mighty proud of his courage and his cleverness. That is what he said. Now, the difficulty is, however, that Protagoras, in contradistinction to the ordinary man, is a teacher not of ordinary human beings, but of potential hombres. Yet he clearly doesn't teach courage. But he teaches only wisdom. He grafts wisdom on pre-existing courage, manliness, extrovertness, whatever you call it. The pupil must come to him already possessing courage, in this sense, self-assertion. And as we know, Hippocrates possesses it. He is called by Socrates himself and a great Andreas. Now, in the discussion in the last section, the chief concern is the relation between wisdom and pleasure. While the other passions were mentioned, the emphasis definitely on pleasure. Can wisdom or knowledge be overcome by pleasure? The ability to resist the allurement of pleasure is ordinarily called moderation or temperance, sophrosyne, not courage. Courage is rather the ability to resist fear, especially the fear of death. If we can trust old Cephalos in the beginning of the Republic, pleasure is more powerful in the young, while fear of death is greater in the old. Now, Protagoras is old, but he does not show any sign of fear of death, even any awareness of death. He does mention death when he speaks of the many, when he speaks of capital punishment and its social function in 325 BC, but otherwise he does not refer to it at all. So Protagoras in this sense is also courageous. This is reinforced by the comparison with Achilles, and which occasion is the best. But Protagoras is surely wise. Every Athenian would say that. He is a living proof that courage is something different from wisdom. He has wisdom and courage, but the fact that Hippocrates has courage without having wisdom shows. Now, a more important consideration. The peculiarity of Protagoras, according to his own claim, is his candor, his daring, his courage. It is true, he mentions the same context that he uses certain precautionary measures, and somehow, from a popular point of view, a man who is very much concerned with precautionary measures is not an embodiment of courage. He has refuge to a myth, that is a refuge for him, to a myth which he himself has suffocated. So his courage is not simply courage, but in a broad sense is courage. Finally, and above all, his claim to teach virtue, while he does not know what virtue is, as we have seen and as Stoics will tell him very soon, his nerve, in colloquial language, is also a kind of courage. One can say that the action of the dialogue as a whole consists in this. Here is a courageous Hippocrates. Here is a courageous Protagoras. Socrates tries to prevent the coming together of these two courageous individuals. Now, Socrates himself is, of course, courageous in a different sense. The most well-known document of that is the Phaedo, how he behaved on the day of death. Now, with whom is Socrates associated here in the dialogue? Alcibiades. So there is a kind of Socrates-Alcibiades combination in contradistinction to the Protagoras-Hippocrates combination. Alcibiades, of course, was the most courageous and daring in the vulgar sense of the word among of all. I mean, what there was absolutely nothing incredible, including various acts of high treason and treachery and so on, which he did not do. And therefore, yes, now, and this, I believe, is of some importance. While preventing the combination Protagoras-Hippocrates, Socrates benefits somehow from the combination Socrates-Alcibiades. I turn now to the second and third question, which is, why is wisdom equal to courage to be proven on the basis of the equation of the good and the pleasant? And why is that equation established in a fictitious dialogue with the many? These two answers must be answered together. And my defective presentation was due to the fact that I did not know it before. Now, after having failed to prove that courage is wisdom in the first part of this argument, Socrates proposes that the good is identical with the pleasant, which Protagoras refuses to accept. Socrates then proposes that knowledge of wisdom is the supreme power in man, and Protagoras, naturally, he lives on that, accepts it. To this extent, there is really something in common between the present-day intellectual and certain people, as different as Socrates and Protagoras in Greece. Now, of course, from the point of view of the sociologist, both Socrates and Protagoras are intellectuals. Can there be the slightest doubt that this is a true statement? Well, and for Plato, this community, so to say, invited statistics, that they are counted as intellectuals by some bureaucrats, or many bureaucrats, is very misleading, because the difference, it all depends what kind of intellectual you are. Right. Socrates brings up the fact that according to the many, knowledge is inferior to a pleasure and the other passion. Protagoras dismisses this view of the many with contempt. Who cares for the many things? I suppose he does it because he sees that this view of the many contradicts his view regarding the supremacy of knowledge, which he had stated immediately before on the ground that it would be especially disgraceful to him not to state it, not to state that it's the intellect or science is the highest. Now, the many imply that the good is different from the pleasant. Let me try to make this
Someone says good equals to pleasant. And he says supremacy of intelligence. Therefore, Ramana stands here is dark. The many surely say the good different. Now, regarding the other point, Protagoras agrees with Socrates regarding the superiority of the intellect. There is a many third, a inferiority. This theme, which Mr. Reiner was a good to draw for me last time, shows immediately that Protagoras is somewhat closer to closer to the many than Socrates is. Now, then Socrates proves to the many, while addressing them on behalf of himself and of Protagoras,
that if the good is the pleasant, no, and I'm sorry, that the good is the pleasant, and what this entails regarding the status of knowledge. Now, what does this mean? Let us turn to an earlier passage which I had not considered before in this connection. 333 B A to C. This is very shortly before the breakdown of the debate between Socrates and Protagoras, and i.e. before the litigation. You know now what I mean by this, because otherwise I would always have to begin from the beginning, which is not very practical. Now, can you read that?
333b. And now, Protagoras, I said, we must finish the inquiry and not get lazy. Do you think that an unjust man can be self-controlled in his injustice?
Yeah, that cannot have here also the governing. Can he be sound? Can he be prudent? That is more the meaning here. Yes?
I should be ashamed, Socrates, he said, to acknowledge this, which nevertheless many may be found to assert.
Many of the human beings say, yeah, now go on.
And shall I argue with them or with you, I replied.
Well, more, perhaps more really, shall I argue against them or against you? Yes.
I would rather, he said, that you should argue with the many first, if you will.
Yes. You see, this has a certain similarity with our debate. Protagoras describes the view that men can act sensibly by acting unjustly to the many. And he refuses to ascribe the view to the many because he would be ashamed to state it on his own. Although it is clearly implied in his view of the five paths of virtue that they are separable. And if they are separable, you can be, you can have prudence, moderation, as you call it, and lack justice. We see here Protagoras lacks the courage to state this opinion as his own. And he took his position behind the apron strings, if I may say so, of the many. In the meantime, but this is ancient history, well, ours have passed. In the meantime, he has become still more cautious. Naturally, he got one beating after the other. Socrates has been taming him all the time. Now, in the last section of the Protagoras, Socrates catches Protagoras by doing the reverse of what Protagoras did in the passage which we just read. In other words, Socrates follows Protagoras' prisoner. So Protagoras takes the many as he sees. And Socrates says, well, I also can do. Now, how does he do it? That is the interesting point. In this passage, which is in 333, Protagoras had presented an immoral view, which he tacitly shared as a view of the many. Now, in the last section, Socrates presents an immoral view which Protagoras tacitly shares, but openly rejects, as Socrates' own view. Socrates courageous says, yes, sure. And the good is the blessed. He first leads the many to admit openly that the good is identical with the pleasant. He leads the many, that is, to Protagoras' concealed view. he then makes it easy for Protagoras to accept this view, accepted by the many, since that view leads to the most wonderful recommendation of sophistry. He thus compares Protagoras to accept openly Protagoras' concealed view by showing that its open profession leads to the most profitable consequence. Now, of course, this is what Protagoras had claimed to do in his very first speech, when he said he is the first who professes to be a sophist because he doesn't pay to conceal it. And Socrates has shown in a long way, which it, we cannot repeat now, of course, that you make a fool of yourself without it, what you do. That's the way to do it. After having made the allegedly cautious Protagoras, in fact cautious, he forced him now to be truly candid. The candor is that he admits him somehow, completely somehow, to admit that the good is the blessing, the disciple. He gives him a lesson in prudence, practical wisdom, phronesis. He shows the alleged teacher of prudence that alleged teacher of prudence lacks prudence. And that is, of course, very fatal, just as if you would show a teacher of mathematics that he doesn't know mathematics. But I believe it is even graver, because a teacher of prudence is, by definition, a man who cannot get into this kind of fixes. This, I believe, is a connection. If it was a bit complicated, that's not my fault. And I believe that there may be some minor inexactnesses in it, I have no doubt, which would make it, if I would try to avoid that, it would be still more complicated. In other words, I would have to write this up in a long presentation. But this is, I believe, nevertheless, a true image of what happens in this dialogue. Yes?
Isn't there a problem that Socrates might not come to grasp the imprudence on the part of Protagoras?
I think that
Hippocrates might not grasp the imprudence of Protagoras because it's sort of underneath.
Mr. Dry, draw on your own experience. You hear a discussion on this campus or elsewhere on a subject of which you know very little. But still in a language which you can follow. I mean, it mustn't be in mathematical symbols which you will know. And there is a wouldn't you see who is licked or not, if it is a matter of victory and defeat?
Well, that certainly, but Socrates does come out praising Sophocles in what might appear to be his
science
of poetry.
Yeah, but the question is Protagoras that is Pfizer of measurement, is he the right man to teach the true art of measurement of pleasure? And many more things. One word about the question which is not discussed in this
here. The claim to originality is now a bit more precise. It is a combination of what Plato did with what, say, Aristotle did and others, whether Aristotle did, it remains on the same plane, that's the point, You know? Because after all, Aristotle was also classical political philosopher. Yes?
But you are for you have approached the subject as if you prefer to give the credit for your own discoveries to others rather than follow the example of Socrates and Plato's work to invent a new state yourself. And in what you have said about the site of your state, you are referring to a definite principle, the things done by Romulus, either by chance or necessity. And in the third place, your discussion does not wander about, but confines itself to a single state.
Yeah, no, all right, what did you say? Where is there that fundamental difference? Is there an assertion about the necessity of an actualization of the perfect Buddha. It is pedagogically much more convenient, of course, with the great premise that this actual regime you study is the best regime, but as patriotic Romans, we have no difficulty to grant that, at least to begin with. Yeah? And then you see also this strange remark. Hear what he says. Jews, Scipio, prefer to ascribe to others what you yourself found. In plain English, the old Romans didn't even dream of those things. But you, out of your generosity, attributed them a wisdom which they didn't possess. What they did by chance or by necessity in the Bergian manner. You idealize consciously by describing as due to wisdom. You see, I would say that Aristotelian's Platonic perspective of superiority of conscious planning to mere accidental becoming is absolutely maintained. And in addition, of course, it throws some doubt on the simple historical validity of what Scipio says about the omnipotence.
Yeah, but you said last time that the belief in natural law and the belief in the theoretical life requires the actualization of that thing, whereas
I give you a simple proof. A man like Plato, Aristotle, led this contemplative life. In which city did they live, at least most of their time? And what was the Athenian regime, in their opinion, the best regime?
No,
that one, oh no, that I never said. What Plato and Aristotle meant was not more than this, that in the best regime, it would be easier for the men, for the fit individuals, to devote themselves to contemplative life in imperfect regime. Yeah? Socrates would not have been executed in Plato's perfect city, that the philosopher's rule. Socrates would not have condemned himself to death. Yeah? Do you see?
Yeah.
Only then. Pardon? Cicero lived in Rome, and he asserts here, through, not in his own name, but through the mouth of Scipio, that the Roman constitution in its old, not yet decayed form was the best it is. Yeah? What follows from that? I mean, what follows from that regarding the theoretical and practical life? Nothing, I would say. But the question which we are concerned is it a happy accident that the best regime was actualized in Rome, which was very good for Cicero, if he had lived in the olden times when it was still unimpaired, or is there an intrinsic necessity for that? Now, to understand this better point, I give you a think forward towards Hegel, according to which there is an intrinsic necessity for living a life.